My name is Gary Strait, and this is Straight from the Road. People are all the time asking me if I'm related to George Strait, and the answer is no. I don't look like him, act like him, walk like him, or talk like him, and I darn sure can't sing like him. But I have written a few country tunes, and that's what part of this story is about. That and a tale about a rock and rollin' road trip from Key West, Florida to Prudhoe Bay, Alaska, and a 1953 Peterbilt motorhome. Although Zelda the Pete averaged 10 miles per gallon, she only had a 50-gallon fuel tank, and my cash reserves rose and fell as drastically as the price of fuel. But somehow I managed to drive from Colorado to Florida, then back to Tennessee, and only ran out of fuel two or three times. Or maybe four. I was pulling a grade outside of Lexington, Kentucky on I-75 when the engine started sucking air, but Zelda managed to crest the hill and coasted off the other side. Momentum carried us up the next hill, then enough fuel sloshed around in the tank to get the engine running one more time. I coasted into a gas station that sold diesel fuel, but fuel was $1.42 a gallon, and they wouldn't accept my credit cards. I didn't want to dip too far into my cash, so I dug around under the sofa cushions and my dirty laundry until I came up with enough change to buy 7 gallons, which bought me another 70 miles of freedom, and that was enough to get me to my cousin's farm near Cynthiana, Kentucky. I've always enjoyed the bluegrass state. I admire the neatly groomed horse farms outlined with freshly painted wood fences and stone borders. I like watching the mares grazing the pastures with foals at their sides. I like the rows of leafy green tobacco plants with the growing small patches along the river bottoms called hollows, or hollers. And I like the smell of freshly cut hay lying in evenly spaced ribbons that follow the contours of the hillsides. Of course, there's the old farmhouses and weathered tobacco barns, many of them dating back to the turn of the century. Some of the barns still have signs painted on their black tin roofs that read Mail Pouch Tobacco, or Sea Rock City. I also enjoy the small towns with odd names like Lee's Lick and Ruddle's Mill. But most of all, I like the people. They're down-home, unpretentious, and generally don't get above their raisin. I turned onto Highway 62, which is a winding two-lane that meanders off in a northeasterly direction. 7 miles north of Cynthiana, Kentucky, lies the once-thriving community of Oddville. Today, the remains of Oddville High School are surrounded by ragweed, thistle, and dandelions. But on May 22, 1941, the handsome red brick building was overflowing with fresh-cut lilacs, peonies, and tiger lilies. Everyone from the neighboring farms put on their Sunday best and assembled in the small gymnasium to watch the class of 41 graduate. There were only 10 graduates, and one of them was my mother, Elberta Munns, more commonly known as Bertie. Across the street from the school were the sagging remains of Whitaker's General Store. The wood structure, which was built on stilts above the creek, is now abandoned, but until the 1960s, the General Store had been a hotbed of activity. We often came to town to cool off after a hard day's work, stretching out in the shade of the wooden porch to sip on RC Colas and munch on moon pies. I cranked Zelda's enormous steering wheel to the right and headed up Oddville Hill. A narrow black hood pointed skyward, and I fell back into the seat as though I was sitting on the front row of a roller coaster. I topped the hill on Beaver Pike and wound around and around and down until I rolled past a tiny creek called James Run. On the far side of the creek was a white L-shaped two-story house with a large front porch. Originally, the house was made of hand-hewn logs, but in later years, the logs were covered with lap siding. The man who built the house was Joseph Munns, my great-great-grandfather. My grandmother, my mother, and most of my aunts and uncles were born in that house. The Munns homestead was once the pride of Beaver Creek, but now the proud old house would keep a handyman hopping. The tobacco barn looks as though the slightest breeze would cause it to topple into the creek, and the current tenants have a junked-out car where my grandmother once planted her flower gardens. During the Civil War, the Union Army rode into this homestead and recruited my great-great-grandfather and left his family to fend for themselves. While Joseph was away fighting against the Confederates, the Union Army returned to this homestead once more and confiscated all of their horses and a large share of their food. My other great-great-grandfather was Robertson Hunt. Legend has it that he came to Kentucky with Daniel Boone. Robertson Hunt also fought in the Civil War, but he fought for the Confederate Army. As a matter of fact, he captured my other great-great-grandfather in the Battle of Cynthiana. At that time, the two men, fighting on opposite sides, had no idea that someday they would lay down their arms, become neighbors, and that their grandchildren would marry. Across Beaver Creek, where my mother was baptized and where my cousins, who were notorious pranksters, hoisted an outhouse to the top of the suspension bridge on Halloween night. The road followed the river, rolled up to the right, and down once more before ascending the grade leading up to Beaver Baptist Church. On the day of June 8, 1946, a local farm girl came home from World War II and married a Colorado cowboy that she had met in the Navy. That was my mom and dad. My cousin's farm is just around the corner from the church and quietly rests in the shadow of the graveyard. If you want to start a rumor mill, park a suspicious-looking black truck next to a cemetery on a hillside in Kentucky and leave it for a couple of days. Zelda the Pete was not the first unusual vehicle to be spotted near that cemetery. During the summer of 1963, when I was about 8 years old, we were sitting on the front porch watching lightning bugs highlight the summer sky as the moon crept up over the tobacco patch. Suddenly, my Aunt Beth came tearing around the house screaming, "Birdie! Birdie! Come here quick!" We bolted to the backyard where Beth had been hanging laundry on the clothesline. She was crouching behind a pair of boxer shorts and pointing towards the cemetery. "My Lord, what is that thing?" my mother asked. Just above the graveyard was a huge red fireball, perhaps 50 feet in diameter. It was hovering about 10 feet off the ground, and there was no sound whatsoever. "Is it the moon? Since when did the moon start coming up from the south?" "Well, what about the sun? If it's the sun, why just go down over the barn and come up again over the church?" Whatever the brightly lit object was, it began to move slowly toward the west, skimming across the top of the tombstones. Then, zip, shot silently across the horizon and disappeared. We jumped in our big old Chrysler and gave chase, racing around the hillsides for over an hour, stopping to ask neighbors if they'd seen anything. They looked at us as though we all had pointed ears and antennas. "Big red ball," one farmer snickered. "Ain't seen one tonight. Saw one the other day when my tractor backfired." Another farmer said, "It's them government weather balloons. Damn government thinks they control the weather better than God Almighty." We'd given up the search and were headed home when we saw the UFO once more, gliding slowly across the treetops right above our heads. It appeared to be stalking us, so I hunkered down on the floor behind the front seat. I've always thought that my only close encounter had been with the floorboard of that old Chrysler, but who knows? That might have been when my pointed ears and antennas were installed. I parked Zelda at the cemetery and walked down to the farm. I found my cousin Mark and several other good old boys leaning on the hood of a pickup. Mark isn't one to get too excited. Therefore, when I strolled in from out of nowhere, he never even batted an eye. He just kept right on talking as though I'd only gone to the store moments before. Then Mark raised one eye and squinted the other. He scanned the western sky like a radar, slowly rotating to the north, then the east, finally shifting his position to the south where his eyes came to rest on me. Then he said, "Expect I ought to wait till tomorrow to cut hay, don't you think?" Which roughly translates into, "Looks like we got company. Think I'll take the afternoon off." Then he said, "You're the big diesel demon. Will a Dodge out pull a Ford?" Before I could answer, someone else blurted, "Hell, my old lady's minivan will outpull a damn Ford." "Shit, your old lady could outpull a Ford." Around my cousin's farm, tormenting, teasing, and pulling pranks aren't merely a favorite pastime. It's the number one spectator sport. In the course of a few minutes, they discussed how far behind the tobacco crop was because there had been too much rain. Then they analyzed the price of stock trailers and finally agreed that a Dodge would outpull a Ford. After that, they moved on to tractor pulling. I learned that if you set the drawbar just right on a Ford 800 Jubilee, it would outpull just about anything in its class. Anything worth knowing had been discussed and agreed upon in the course of a few minutes. Too bad the government doesn't operate so efficiently. Then the meeting was adjourned to the ballpark in town where we watched my second cousin's oldest boy play in a baseball tournament. It drizzled rain throughout the game, but no one wanted to throw in the towel because the winners were going to the state tournament. During the game, Mark kept pointing out people and quizzing me. "See that girl down there with the baby?" "Yeah." "Know who that is?" "No." "That's your cousin Greg's little girl, Mary Beth." "Holy smokes. Last time I saw her, she was riding a tricycle." "See that guy leaning on the backstop? That's your other cousin, Mark Thomas." "I haven't seen him in 20 years. Then Mark shouted to the kid playing third base who had just missed a ground ball. "You better find a handle on that darn ball," he said with a grin. Then he turned to me and spoke in confidential tones. "Y'all recognize that kid playing third base?" "Ain't got a clue." "That's his mama sitting right over there." I studied a lady sitting on the bleachers, then shook my head. "No." "Better look again. You took her to the drive-in picture show a few years back." Then Mark leaned back and gave me one of them pregnant stares. He was insinuated that I'd sown some wild oats and not stuck around for the harvest. During my younger years, while I was still living in a hormonal hurricane, I borrowed my cousin's Vega hatchback and escorted Betty Ann Ledbetter to the drive-in picture show to see True Grit. After the Duke rode off into the sunset for the last time, I took Betty Ann for a drive and found a horse farm with a tree-lined driveway that was at least a quarter mile long. I turned out the headlights and eased the Vega into the lane and parked under a huge oak tree. The back seat of the Vega folded down, and within minutes, Betty Ann and I were huddled under the hatchback and struggling to shed our clothes and our inhibitions. However, the humidity was rising much faster than the heat of passion, and within minutes we were desperately gasping for air. The hatchback could only be opened from the outside, so I grabbed the keys and slipped out the front door wearing only my BVDs. I tiptoed barefoot through the dewy grass to the rear of the car and was fumbling with the keys when I drew the attention of a pack of dogs that were up at the house. The dogs were less than 100 yards away from sinking their teeth into my posterior when I finally got the hatchback unlocked. But just as the lid sprung open, Betty Ann's head popped out, causing me to drop the keys in the thick grass. To make matters worse, Betty Ann started hurling recycled groceries out the back of the car and buried the keys under a mound of partially digested popcorn, chili dogs, and cherry coke. I looked in the direction of the approaching dogs, then looked at the gooey mess at my feet, then looked at the dogs once more before stabbing my hand into the slimy mess and retrieving the keys only moments before sacrificing my own hot dog to the jaws of a hungry hound. "Wait a minute," I said to my cousin. "That was 25 years ago, and that kid playing third base ain't a day over 13. Besides that, I never even made it to first base with Betty Ann Ledbetter." And so the night went on, sitting there in a misty rain at the ballpark, with the bright lights casting shadows on my family tree, while my cousin made light of my sporting past. By the way, the home team won the game, of course. I woke up the next morning in Zelda and felt someone staring at me. I raised up, looked out the window, and found a Mormon's feed cap pressed against the window with two hands cupped around a pair of squinted eyes. When those eyes met mine, they doubled in size, and the old farmer that belonged to the cap turned and scurried back to his pickup. He disappeared around the corner, only to be replaced by another pickup and another curious farmer. The rumors about the big black truck at the cemetery were in full swing.
"Hey, did y'all see that big old hearse-looking thing up at the church?"
"Ain't no dang hearse. That's one of them government spy trucks. That's headquarters for them black helicopters."
"Government spy truck? What the hell kind of tobacco you been smoking? That's a dang hearse if I ever seen one."
"A hearse? For who? The Jolly Green Giant? That thing's so big you could haul a whole damn county off."
That morning, the first major traffic jam in the history of Beaver Pike occurred right there next to the cemetery. There were 4 pickups, 2 tractors, a milk truck, a water truck, 6 dogs, and twice that many farmers, most of whom I was kin to. I may not be kin to George Strait, but I am kin to half of Harrison County, Kentucky, and that's all right by me. Everybody gathered around Zelda's back porch and listened to my demo tape while my cousins told stories about my adolescent adventures.
"I remember when Gary's just a little sprout. He had one of them little cowboy outfits. He'd stand up there on that front porch with his little guitar and bang on that guitar and sing, 'Wow, why is everybody always picking on me?'"
For some reason, I got the feeling things hadn't changed much in 20 years.
"Well, y'all should have seen him and old Tony down at the Germantown Fair when they was about 15. I told them they better not sneak in that hoochie-coochie show. Of course, that's like putting a bull in a pen full of heifers and telling that bull to keep 4 hooves on the ground. One of them old hoochie-coochie gals wanted to volunteer, so old Tony pushed Gary up there on that stage. He wasn't singing, but he sure put on a show when that old hoochie-coochie gal gave him a powder puff and told him to rub it on her udders." He was just about to reach up and touch them things when she took that box of baby powder and dumped it all over his head. He was covered from head to toe in baby powder and looked like a ghost when he jumped off that stage and ran like hell. But everybody knew he'd been to the Hoochie Coochie Show because he had the mark of the Hoochie Coochie Beast. The laughter barely died down when another cousin started in on another story. Hey, y'all remember the time your big brother Greg smashed that rotten egg on your head? No, somehow that slipped my mind. Slipped your mind? Hell, ain't nobody ever forgot having a rotten egg smashed on his head. He ignored my protest and told the story anyway. When Gary and Gregor were kids, they fought like a couple of honorable roosters. Of course, big brother always beat the snot out of little brother, and the only thing Gary could do was start in cussing. And I'm a-telling you, when he started in cussing, he sounded like a Baptist preacher. Hot damn, you son of a bitch! You're going to pay for that someday! That's when Gregory appointed himself the cussing sheriff. I don't think it was as much out of moral outrage as it was for self-preservation, because Gregory knew that Aunt Beth and Miss Birdie could hear every word, and there was only one place Gary could have learned all them dirty words, and that was from his big brother. Then one morning they were down at the barn, and next thing you know, them boys commenced to fighting and kicking and wrestling, and Gary started in on one of his cussing sermons. You hot damn son of a bitch! That's when the cussing sheriff wrestled his little brother to the ground, conveniently close to where he had hidden a rotten egg. Big brother reached under the hay, grabbed that egg, held it over little brother's head, and said, okay, you say one more cuss word, and I'll smash this rotten egg on your head. Gary looked up at his big brother and went, shit. And that whole egg went, splat. You would not believe what the smell of a rotten egg does to improve a young man's vocabulary. My cousin spent the better part of the morning spitting tobacco and telling stories on me, but they didn't mean any harm and nobody was laughing louder than I was. Them good old boys ain't half bad, and I hated to leave, but I had places to go and people to see. One of my cousins drew a map in the dust on Zelda's fender, giving me directions to a shortcut to the highway. But here's a word to the wise. Never take directions from a prankster. Zelda just barely fit between the trees as I headed down Smithsonville Hill, and at the bottom of the hill there was a creek without a bridge. There was, however, some concrete poured over the rocks to hold them together, so I drove Zelda right into the water and out the other side. Then I turned onto another trail that took me through several farmyards. In horse and buggy days, the trails that led from one farm to the next ran straight through the middle of each farm. The houses were only 100 feet from the barns, but the trails ran right between the two. The only difference between then and now is that the trails are paved with oil and gravel. A farmer who was working on his tractor looked up and saw Zelda. He lifted his cap and drug a shirt sleeve across his forehead as he stared at the big black truck. His wife paused from hanging clothes on the line and waved as their children ran alongside a white picket fence and pumped their fists wildly towards the sky, trying to coax a toot from Zelda's air horn. Then a curious horse stuck its head out of a barn window. The barn was so close to the road that I stopped and leaned out of Zelda's window and scratched the horse's nose. It was a scene straight off a Norman Rockwell canvas. I was fairly certain that my cousins had pulled another prank on me. However, this time, the joke was on them. I finally did make it to Highway 27 and headed north to Cincinnati, Ohio, where I got on I-74. From there, it was a straight shot to Davenport, Iowa, where I jumped on I-80. Every year, the Iowa 80 Truck Stop hosts a trucker's jamboree, which features new trucks, antique trucks, custom trucks, live bands, and carnival tents filled with vendors hawking everything from peanuts to lug nuts. It's the equivalent of a county fair for truckers. I wanted to display Zelda with the antique trucks, but I also wanted to sell my tapes and t-shirts, which meant I had to pay a vendor fee. My cash reserve was less than $400, but I reluctantly handed over the $300. The show didn't start until the next day, but dozens of folks drifted by and asked questions about Zelda. I gave them the 50-cent tour for free and sold several tapes and t-shirts. When the show opened the next morning, hordes of people showed up, and I was so overwhelmed giving tours and answering questions that I hardly sold a tape. Fortunately, some folks saw my predicament and came to the rescue. Carl was an old-time trucker from Kentucky who had slick back gray hair, a full beard, and a pair of suspenders stretched over his ample torso.
His daughter Heather was a shy teenage country girl with a soft, sweet southern drawl. She had a passion for horses and old trucks, and her dream was to drive her 1948 Chevy pickup to Wyoming and find herself a real cowboy. Brian was an energetic 15-year-old who came to the truck show with his grandfather. His love for big trucks was reflected in his collection of model trucks. Carl stepped into the passing crowd and blurted out like an old-time carnival barker, "Hey, y'all like good country music?" The couple he was addressing were slightly taken aback by Carl's enthusiastic approach.
"I said, do y'all like country music?"
"Sure," the man responded. "Is there any other kind?"
"Then step right over here, son."
Carl guided them towards Zelda.
"See that fellow in the back of that big old black Peterbilt? He's traveling all over the country writing songs and stuff, and he's got them tapes for sale."
They leaned in and stared at me as though I were a two-headed cow or a goat with five legs, which is exactly how I felt. Heather handed the man a tape. "They're only $5. The woman leaned on her husband's arm and read the cover of the tape. "Gary Strait." She looked up. Is he any kin to George?"
No, ma'am, I don't think so."
I was relieved that someone else was fielding those questions. Then Brian went to work.
"The caps are only $7. Get a tape and a ball cap for $10.
Carl, Heather, and Brian were a lively trio, and within minutes they became a lean, mean selling machine, while I gave the 50-cent tours for free. After the sun went down, the show trucks turned on their marker lights. Chicken haulers, or rooster cruisers, generally like to decorate their trucks with extra lights, and now the term chicken lights applies to just about any light on any truck. I was checking out the light show and bumped into a trucker from Nashville.
"I listened to your demo tape this afternoon. Man, I got to tell you, I really enjoyed them songs."
James was a big man in his 50s who had a broad smile and an intense stare. He spoke in an easy southern rhythm that reminded me of a sourdough biscuit being dragged through Cairo syrup.
"The right person gets a hold of them lyrics and adds his own style to the music, man, they'd do all right. What you need to find is a country boy who's been around the block a few times, but still ain't afraid to sing a country song. I could see a long-legged cowboy singing about them long-legged horses and them long-legged Porsches and them long-legged cowgirls in tight blue jeans."
"I'll be damned, you did listen to the tape, didn't you?"
"Of course I did. I listened 2 or 3 times. Now, you take that song, what is it, Born on Wheels or something like that? I spent my whole life out here on the highway, and that's a song a guy like me can relate to."
"I'm glad at least one person from Nashville thinks that way," I said.
"Don't pay any attention to them folks. Half of them are from L.A., James said. "I grew up in Nashville, and there's not a soul on the face of this earth that loves country music any more than me. Now, there's people down there that never even heard a country song before they came to town, and they're trying to tell me what I'm supposed to like. There was a kid on TV the other day, sitting there with his big old cowboy hat and his big old cowboy boots, and he had the nerve to say he wanted to get away from the country stuff. He might as well have said, 'Hey, all you stupid rednecks, I got rich and famous singing your songs. You paid for my big old tour bus and my big old house and my big old Mercedes-Benz, but the truth is, I want to do some serious music.'"
James shook his head and said,
"I look forward to the day those people go on back to L.A. and leave us country boys alone."
There was a wide variety of folks attending the truck show, but most of them were truckers, and many of them were old-timers. One old gentleman stood at the front of Zelda with his hands folded behind his back, carefully studying every inch of the cab. He was wearing a clean denim shirt, khaki breeches, polished work boots, and had a Peterbilt cap perched on his head at a 60-degree angle.
"What are you thinking?" I asked. "She's a beauty. Used to drive one just like her. Of course, mine didn't have a big fancy smancy camper on the back."
I opened the driver's door and said, "Go ahead, climb on in." Climbing inside a man's truck is like going in his home, but I assured the old gentleman that it was okay. After all, hundreds of people had crawled in and out of the camper, but I hadn't allowed very many folks the opportunity to sit in the driver's seat. I held the door open and coaxed him in, and he cautiously slipped into the seat. He sat quietly staring out the window, his hands gingerly tracing the rim of the huge ceramic steering wheel. He skimmed his fingers across the row of brass switches on the dash, then examined each one.
headlights, marker lights, fog lights, ignition, and jake brake. He wrapped his beefy palm around the shift knob on the main transmission. The knob was made from an old billiard cue ball that had been drilled and tapped so that it would screw onto the shift lever. He rocked the lever back and forth to get a feel for the gears, then moved his hand to the auxiliary transmission. After he placed his hands on the steering wheel at 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock, he took a deep breath and said, "Now this is a real truck. Took a real truck driver to handle one of these babies." He paused a few minutes, then added, "You know, it ain't the same out here anymore. In my day, you could hold your head up high and be proud to be a trucker. People used to respect us. Hell, they depended on us. We changed tires in the rain, carried extra gas, and guided folks through blizzards. We even helped the highway patrol when there was an accident. We were the knights of the highway." I could tell his mind was moving 90 miles an hour down some ancient two-lane, like Route 66 or Old 30. Faces of loved ones faded in and out of the mirrors while a million miles of memories disappeared beneath the long black hood. The melancholy rumble of straight stacks echoed in his ears, blending with the sounds of lively conversations once shared over a steaming hot cup of coffee at some forgotten roadhouse. The drivers were either bitching about their loads or bragging about how fast them trucks would go. Drivers, waitresses, dispatchers, and highway patrolmen. A lifetime of memories passed through the old trucker's mind. He took a deep breath and sighed, then climbed down from the cab and said, "Thank you, son." He walked away, stopped, turned around to look once more, then quietly disappeared, just like the old knights of the highway had done. During a slow spell on the second day of the show, I was sitting on Zelda's back porch and thumbing through my cash. A man walked by and said, "Don't ever count your money in the middle of the game, you'll lose your ass." It was only a passing comment from a stranger, but the words resonated like a curse. Within an hour, the rains came and the crowds left. The folks that did stick around took shelter inside the carnival tents, so we locked up Zelda and joined them, hoping that the weather would cooperate the next day. The next morning, I woke up to the sound of rain drumming on Zelda's roof. I looked out the window and saw the parking lot was flooded, and Zelda was up to her axles in water. By late afternoon, the rain was falling so hard that water accumulated in the swells of the circus tent faster than it could drain off. Then gale-forced winds came and nearly blew the tents away. Anyone with common sense would have taken refuge inside the restaurant, but we were having a regular Boy Scout survival camp. Despite the turn of bad luck, I was feeling young at heart and found a few excuses to run across the parking lot and splash through the mud puddles with Heather and Brian. The rains continued for the rest of the show, but the kids stuck it out with me until the end. I appreciated their help, so I went to the gift shop and bought Heather a Western shirt for her trip to Wyoming, and I bought a model truck for Brian to add to his collection. The rains had drenched any hopes of showing a profit, therefore I left the show with far less cash than when I arrived, but I was a lot richer with new friends. After the truck show was over, some of the drivers were going to a hot rod show in Pella, Iowa, and they invited me to come along. When I first conceived the idea of Zelda the Pete, I had imagined a huge hot rod, and that's exactly what she was. Therefore, a hot rod show sounded like a perfect place to go. So the next thing I know, I'm headed down a tiny two-lane road that wove its way through endless miles of Iowa cornfields. Pella is a predominantly Dutch farm town that's famous for its tulips and bologna. The center of downtown was the town square, which was bordered on four sides with turn-of-the-century brick buildings and storefronts. The side streets were lined with gingerbread houses with expertly kept lawns and gardens that were brimming with flowers. Even the buildings in the industrial parks were ornamented with trees, potted plants, and gardens. I drove past the town square, and the streets were overflowing with hot rods of every imaginable description and color. There were pickups, coupes, sedans, T-buggets, muscle cars, lowriders, and antiques lined up with their hoods saluting skyward. The colorful paint jobs seemed to be an extension of the flower gardens. I circled the town square a couple of times, but on the second trip around, a lady stepped in front of Zelda. At first, I thought she was going to ask me to leave, but then she took down a barricade and directed me through the opening. A crowd gathered around the moment I stopped, and I was accosted with the usual questions and comments. To be honest, I was getting really sick of talking about Zelda, and sick of giving 50-cent tours for free, so I only gave them a 45-cent tour. One man asked about the demo tapes that were stacked on the shelves, and I sold him one. Then I sold another one. Then another, and another. It turned into a feeding frenzy, and within minutes I had a fistful of cash. But this time I didn't stop to count my money. Once the crowd dispersed, I strolled around to look at the cars, and I recognized a couple who had bought a tape from me during the feeding frenzy. They were sitting on a park bench and invited me to join them. The gentleman had a distinguished air about him, and his wife was attractive, elegant, and very friendly. They were dressed in expensive casual clothes, and I guessed them to be in their late 50s. I assumed they were professionals, but I didn't ask, and they didn't offer.
"Why did you build a rig such as that?" the gentleman asked with a cordial smile.
"I don't know. I guess I'm full of crazy ideas."
"I heard that you were driving all the way to Alaska," the woman said.
"Yes, ma'am. I started out in Key West, and I'm headed to Prudhoe Bay."
"And whatever possessed you to want to do a thing like that?"
The man asked the question like an attorney would. In other words, he already knew the answer.
"Wanderlust, I guess."
"We love to travel," the lady said while patting her husband on the thigh. "But we usually travel with other couples on destination tours."
"We're getting a little tired of that, though. The other couples are nice, but we want to do something a little less organized, something more adventurous, perhaps even dangerous."
"We've talked about buying an old car and just taking off like a couple of kids," the lady added.
"Or a Harley," the man added. "How long would it take to learn to ride a motorcycle?"
"You've never ridden a motorcycle and you want to buy a Harley?" I asked. The gentleman picked up on my astonishment.
"Yes, our children seem to think we've lost our minds."
The couple smiled at each other, pleased that they'd been able to shock their children. Then the lady spoke in a comical, high-pitched voice.
"Well, children, you're all grown now. You've finished college and started your families and careers. Now your father and I have decided that we want to buy a Harley-Davidson and go join the Hell's Angels. What else would you expect us to do?"
"Well, I guess you could just get one of them Winnebagoes."
I said goodbye to the folks on the park bench and strolled down the sidewalk. I was checking out a 72 Chevy pickup with the words, "The Pickup Man," lettered across the tailgate, and heard a raspy Midwestern voice speak out from underneath a shade tree. The owner of the voice and the pickup was a salty old dog named Jim, who had a Dennis the Menace grin and a stogie trapped between his gritted teeth.
"Y'all like them old Chevys?"
"Yes, sir. My dad had one like that when I was a kid."
"Got a couple more at home in the shed. One's a lowrider. The other one's stock. You'd like that stocker. It's only got 7,000 miles on it."
"A 72 that only has 7,000 miles?
I'm lying or I'm dying. Come see for yourself."
The pickup man was a likable old cuss, so when the sun went down and the car show broke up, I followed Jim and his wife Lola to their farm. It was dark when we arrived, so I parked Zelda in the driveway and went to bed. The next morning, I woke up and felt something staring at me. I looked out a side window and saw endless rows of corn stretching toward the horizon. I looked out the other side and saw a dozen or so dairy cows leisurely taking their breakfast in a lush green pasture. Then I looked out the front window and found two pair of eyes studying me. Then another pair of eyes appeared. There were at least three cats sitting on Zelda's hood. Suddenly, they bolted off to the side, and I leaned out to see what had captured their interest. It was Jim. He was walking across the yard with two cups of coffee in hand, and he was completely surrounded by farm cats of every size, shape, and color. He offered me one of the cups of coffee and said,
"Y'all drink this stuff?"
I climbed down out of Zelda and gladly wrapped my hands around the warm cup, letting the steam soothe my eyes as I sipped the coffee. After stretching my bones, I surveyed the surrounding cornfields.
"Is this heaven?"
"No, it's just home. We like it."
"It feels like home."
"Let's go out to the shed and I'll show you around."
Jim led me out to his shed, which turned out to be a 5,000-square-foot shop that would have been the envy of Dale Earnhardt's pit crew. Tools and project cars lined both walls, but parked in the center of the shop was the pickup man's pride and joy. Three immaculate 72 Chevy pickups. The first one was the orange truck that I'd seen at the car show. The second was a teal green lowrider, and the third truck was a bright red and white Chevy Cheyenne that was in pristine condition. I peeked in the window of the 24-year-old truck, and the odometer read 6,783 miles. I was astonished. The premium road machine had barely been out of the garage. Jim and Lola made me feel at home, and they had a little trouble talking me into sticking around for a couple of days. I could have easily spent the rest of the summer there, but whatever the reason, on the third morning I was feeling the urge to merge back onto the big road. I said my goodbyes, but before I pulled out of the driveway, Jim asked me to pull Zelda up to the shed. "What for?" I asked.
"Just pull up there," he insisted.
Jim took the hose from a bulk fuel tank and shoved it in Zelda's fuel tank.
"I looked in there this morning. You ain't got enough fuel to get to Des Moines."
I protested, but he shrugged me off. So I stood there watching Jim pump fuel into Zelda's tank, and suddenly I realized he was enjoying himself. And I asked myself why. Before I left home, it seemed as though most folks ridiculed me and did everything to stand in my way. And some of those folks were my closest friends. But once the adventure was underway, folks did anything and everything to encourage me and keep me going. And they were total strangers.
Please fast forward to side B.